Thanks very much, Peter. I hope my voice holds out. I feel a bit like Hillary Clinton has been sounding. At 7 o'clock this morning, I was out at Leonda talking to 360 Rotarians and high school students. Winging it at 7 o'clock in the morning is an interesting experience for someone who can't even have a conversation normally before about 9:30, as my wife tells me. I do have a prepared speech, which I gave at CEDA in Sydney, but I don't think I'm going to use it unless I dry up, because I don't actually like reading speeches. I think it's kind of tedious. The text of the speech, I think CEDA still has it, and if they don't have it, I'm very happy to send it to them so that they can distribute it, if you actually want to see what you might have heard. I shall open with the fact that I have absolutely no credentials in business whatever. I'm a university academic. I've served on a few committees here and there, but I've never developed a product. And until I started writing books, I'd never even sold a product. I've written a couple of books, one on science and how it works, which has the nauseating title of The Beginner's Guide to Winning the Nobel Prize, which has actually sold remarkably well. And because I think kids, much to their chagrin, are given it as high school graduation presents or given it by their grandmothers. And the other book is A Light History of Hot Air, because I wanted to read up on the global warming issue and did so, and realised I couldn't comment with any great authority on that issue because it's a very complex one. It's far from my area of science. But I did write a book on burning and being burned, which is totally irresponsible and goes all over the place, but I had a lot of fun with it. I'm now trying to write the first great Jane Austen murder mystery climate change novel. In my spare time. My real daytime job is actually, I'm still involved in science. We have a laboratory at the University of Melbourne, just across from the Royal Melbourne Hospital in the microbiology department. We have a lot of outstanding young scientists working with us. We have no lack of very bright young kids wanting to work with us. The only thing that's a bit disturbing, it's not disturbing in one sense, because there has been an imbalance between men and women in science, not so much in biology, but in general, is that just about everyone who's working with us is a girl. There are not many boys going into this area of science. I think they're all going off in the hope that one day they'll head Macquarie Bank. I wonder why that is. But I think maybe they're going more into engineering and the physical sciences. We work on very basic aspects of cellular immunity, the killer T cell response, the white blood cells that float around in the blood and bump off other cells. And Ian Fraser, for instance, is trying to develop an immunotherapy for the human papillomavirus based on that type of technology. There's a lot of work going on in trying to develop those tumour immunotherapy type approaches using these killer T cells. So we work basically on that. There's about 15 people, I think, currently working in that group. And then in Memphis, Tennessee, I'm still doing work on the avian influenza viruses, the bird flu, because the institution there houses Dr. Robert Webster, a New Zealand agriculturalist trained in Australia, who is the world's great authority on the bird flus. At the age of 75, he got a 7-year $8 million a year grant. So he's even worse than my friend David Pennington down here. He doesn't know when to stop. So that's what I do in my real daytime job. I'm still very interested in this whole global warming issue. And for relaxation, apart from trying to write a bad novel, I like to watch old movies. And the other night, I was down, we got a little house at Point Lonsdale, and turned on the television and realised that I'd missed half of a movie called Sophie's Shoal, which I wanted to see for years. It's a movie about a group of young medical students in Nazi Germany who in 1943, they were called the White Rose, wrote and distributed pamphlets saying that the Second World War was unwinnable for Germany, that they had to stop and bring it to a conclusion as soon as possible, and that there was only going to be a disaster. Of course, that wasn't exactly popular with the Nazis, and the Gestapo found them very quickly, of course, because they were amateurs. And the tension of the movie is the interview process between Sophie Scholl, who is clearly a very moral, ethical young woman, a medical student, who also a devout Catholic, and the interrogator, who is not such a terrible person for being a National Socialist, and was a country policeman and has then been elevated to this rank, and feels that Germany would never have got out of the chaos it was in after the First World War if it hadn't been for the National Socialists and Hitler. Of course, you know, we can bear some responsibility for the chaos Germany was in after the First World War, because our Prime Minister, the great Billy Hughes, was one of the people who insisted vehemently that Germany would have to pay massive reparations, which caused the economic disaster in Germany. There's a book about this, I think, by Don Markwell, who was formerly head of Trinity College. So, you know, with Howard taking us to Iraq and Billy Hughes getting the reparations, we do play a role on the international scene. We helped the rise of Hitler. Anyway, of course, Sophie Scholl and the young people working with him were all executed. But the reason I raise this is that this is a true story, and I don't know how accurate the dialogue is, but in the defence, when the brother, Hans Scholl, talks up, he says, the defeat of Germany is because the Americans and the British and the Russians are now all against us. The defeat of Germany is a mathematical certainty. Now, he was absolutely right, of course. It was a mathematical certainty. There is no way they could have prevailed. And it was a very Germanic thing to say, too, that it is a mathematical certainty, that it does kind of exemplify the way that thinking works. And I started to think about that, though, and I started to think about mathematical certainties, and I started to think about some of the mathematical certainties and the numbers that we face. Now, as a scientist, my life is about numbers. You might not think that. I'm a biologist. You might think that I've spent all my life floating around in a white coat, pipetting things in and out of tubes and looking down a microscope where there's nothing on the stage, because that's what you see on the television all the time. You know, television conveys this image. And we have no reporters anymore. They've been replaced by helicopters. When the Queen of the Netherlands was coming through the Heads, I was down at Point Lonsdale. We looked out. I don't think there were any reporters there, but there were three helicopters. You can buy a lot of journalists for a helicopter, right? So image is everything. Of course, I was thrown out of the lab years ago. I'm too slow and too stupid. They talked to me about results, but they would never let me do an experiment. But numbers are everything to us, and science progresses because we get numbers. The science is about measurement. It's about theory and hypothesis and ideas. But in the end analysis, it's about getting numbers. It's about finding that those numbers are repeatable and reproducible and publishing them so that other people can reproduce your results. And that's the thing that took us from the Middle Ages, where science began about 500 years ago, that doing the experiment rather than just being a scholastic and just speculating about how the world is, or, you know, whether the blood ebbs and flows. I mean, actually doing some dissection helps you tell that it goes around the body, as Harvey did. So it's that that makes science, and that's why science has been so enormously powerful. And that's why over the past 500 years our world has been transformed. We no longer have a situation where we had, say, in the Middle Ages, where in 1350 or whatever it was, that the Black Death hit England, that it killed half the people in English cities, half the people, half to a third of the population. That went on for hundreds of years. I mean, this didn't just stop. It went on for hundreds of years. And, you know, science has stopped that. We didn't understand that the germ theory of infectious disease until Pasteur and Koch in the 19th century. We thought that infection was caused by miasmas. It was partly because, you know, if you lived in a malaria-infested swamp, there were all these mists that came off the swamp, so you attributed the infection to the mists, not to the mosquito and the transmission. Same with yellow fever. So it's really modern science is only about 150, 100 years old. Science itself and the way we think of it is about 400 or 500 years old. We could go back to the Greeks, but what the Greeks did was a lot of that was lost. It was lost because it was accumulated in the Grand Library of Alexandria, and that was suppressed under the early Christian emperors. Some of it was saved by the Muslims, who were very enlightened in the early part of their history and passed on to us. But we did, we think, probably lose an enormous amount. Well, what's been the consequence of science? Well, the consequence of science, you can see if you look around this room, is we lead happier, in the main, healthier and longer lives. We certainly live longer lives than we have ever done. Vaccines first emerge on the scene in the late 19th century, Pasteur made a rabies vaccine, diphtheria vaccines and so forth. Antisera were made early in the 20th century. Some of the early Nobel Prizes were for things like that. And we started to deal with infectious disease. We cleaned up the water supplies. We got rid of the cholera. We'd already done smallpox, or started the smallpox vaccination without even knowing about infection and immunity in any very deep sense under Jenner 200 years ago, 1776, actually. And 1796, actually, a bit after Australia was founded. And so that, with antibiotics coming along this century, then the drugs, the Lipitor and so forth, that many of the, looking around this room, I'd reckon there's a lot of people taking Lipitor, and there's a lot more taking blood pressure medication. Scientists of my generation, Ian Clunies Ross was dead, I think, before he was 60 from cardiovascular disease. Howard Florey lived a bit longer, but he was suffering from severe angina for years. He was the penicillin guy, Australian. His angina was so bad he had traffic lights outside his door. If it was green, you could go in. If it was orange, you went at your peril. If it was red and you went in, he would kill you. And the guy was just in pain. We don't have that anymore. We've even stopped doing a lot of bypasses because of the medication is so good. So these are enormous advances. So what's been the effect of that? Well, the effect of that is that if you go back to the time of Christ, as far as we can determine, there are about 300 million people on the planet, okay? Up to 1900, I think that had risen to about a billion. So over 1900 years, we'd increased the size of the human family about three times. We'd done that in various ways. We were distributing excess Europeans all around the world, so dumping them in places like Australia. Well, firstly, we dumped them in America, and then, of course, they kicked the British out, so they had to dump them somewhere else. So that's us. The younger sons didn't succeed. They all went off somewhere else and all that sort of thing, colonising. They had a very jolly time. And, of course, we're paying for some of that now. So it's about a billion people about 1900, about a billion people. By the end of the 20th century, we're getting well into the Industrial Revolution. We're producing a lot of smoke and a lot of machinery and all sorts of things. They're very innovative, steam trains and steamships, steam battleships, all this sort of stuff. By the end of the 19th century, we've got about 1.6 billion people. Agriculture had improved and we'd cleaned up the water supply. That was a big effect there. But through the 20th century, between 1900 and 2000, the population of the world increased by a factor of four. Now, if you're talking about mathematics and mathematical certainty, that's a pretty big certainty, and it brings about various factors that we cannot simply ignore. And that's due, it's due to improvements in health, it's due to improvements in nutrition. The Green Revolution of the 1960s, Norman Borlaug, the wheat breeders working in these agricultural institutes around the world, 1970 Peace Prize to Borlaug, made it much more possible to feed much larger numbers of people. And, of course, he's lauded for that. But you have to ask ourselves whether in the sense of the long-term future of humanity, actually feeding all those people has actually helped us in the long term, because it's simply increased numbers. And that's what's been happening. Numbers increase as the opportunity increases. So let's say a little bit more about increases in numbers. Well, we could talk about global warming and we might say a bit about that, but just in terms of increases in numbers. The increase in numbers has all been in the developing world. Countries like ours, and like the United States, if they've grown in population, they've grown by immigration, not by reproduction in the native population. Now, of course, that's given us many advantages. One of the great strengths of the United States, which people really underestimate when they say, we can write off the US, is their tremendous openness as a society and the fact that they're still dragging talent from everywhere. Even in the present situation, even in a situation where research grants are not nearly as available, where nobody loves George W. Bush, certainly in intellectual circles, intellectual circles and George W. Bush are not something you normally put together. The guy is not all bad. He is not all bad. He actually put a lot of money into treating AIDS in Africa, the PEPFAR program, and he's actually got some adherence to some of his so-called his stated beliefs, at least. So the US is still a drain for talent. It's still pulling people. It's pulling them from Europe in large numbers. One of the things, the reasons it's been pulling them from Europe is because of the very aggressive laws they have on things like genetic engineering and mouse experimentation. The Europeans have really been shooting themselves in the foot in a pretty big way. Even the US may be doing that a little because, you know, things that the US might not do, they're sure as hell going to do in China. You know, the Chinese have no problem with doing an experiment with about 10 million people and seeing what happens. I mean, they wouldn't do it lightly, but they do. And so the US is still a great powerhouse because of that immigration, and it's certainly helped us. I mean, you can look around at our universities and our innovators, and you can see there are quite a number of people who were born elsewhere, and that's always been the case. We're a nation of immigrants. But our populations, if you're looking at natural increase, have been falling. And the reason they've been falling, of course, is very obvious to all of us. It's because of the birth control pill. It's because the status of women has totally changed. And, of course, no one would want to go backwards on that, except maybe some recent politicians who've left office. And of course, the Pope is not very happy about it. Despite my Catholic name, I was actually brought up as a Methodist, so, you know, I don't worry too much about keeping the Pope happy. Wish him well. Our local priest refers to him as Eggs Benedict, but that's, I guess that's rather sacrilegious, isn't it, really? they would have burnt my ancestor at the stake anyway. So, so they're not too happy about it. And any group, actually, that really relies on breeding to outwit its competition, whether it be a tribal group or a religious group, is not very happy. But our populations have been stabilising or falling. And, of course, that's great. That's a matter of great concern with large numbers of older people and how do you pay for this using the sort of social security systems we have. The increase has all been in the developing world. And the increase in the developing world has been massive. And it's reflected, I think, the increase in food production. It's reflected the fact we've got vaccines around the place. You may think, well, what about Africa? Africa's got a massive AIDS pandemic. Well, there are 6.4 billion people on the planet, and about 3 million people are dying of AIDS. Now, they're pretty horrible numbers, and there's some pretty mathematical horrible certainties about that. But it doesn't really make that much difference, strangely enough, to the population equation. There's also massive deaths from tuberculosis, though a lot of those are resulting from AIDS. You know, people often don't die from AIDS. AIDS destroys their immune system, and then the bacteria come in and they kill you. It's like the American argument. Guns don't kill people. People don't kill people. Well, guns don't kill people. Bullets do, actually. And then there's malaria. About 1 million children a year die of malaria. Now, there is a big factor. Getting population growth stabilised in the developing world, which we must do, will depend on increasing prosperity in that world. We cannot expect people to limit their family size in a situation where there is no social security, no retirement benefits, no health care, if the people who are going to look after them in their old age and care for them are their family. Now, we can't expect them to limit their family size if children are dying. So we must increase health options and health opportunities in the developing world. We must distribute vaccines to them. We've been trying to do that. I spoke at Rotary this morning. Rotary International has done a wonderful job paying for most of the polio vaccine that was used around the world in the polio elimination campaign. Ran into problems in West Africa when somebody read the label on the bottle that said sterile, and then a politician said, that means the Americans have put something in it that sterilises you. No, this is real. The polio vaccination campaign faltered because the imams and so forth said to their people, you're not to take this because you will have no children. And then the virus in the Muslim country was transmitted back to Indonesia, and we got outbreak again in Indonesia. It's now going ahead again. And what they did is actually get, I think they got the vaccine made in a Muslim country, I think in Malaysia, so that then they would trust the product. So we have to ensure a better distribution of opportunity and a better distribution of wealth and a better distribution of health care in those developing countries if we want to get advances. Now, there are tremendous problems there. You do have to change social attitudes. When Rwanda blew up, it was the most densely populated agricultural society on earth. Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, is attributing the disaster in Darfur to climate change because there's been a lot less rainfall in East Africa, and he's saying that this is putting enormous pressure on land, water, agricultural resources, and that's a lot of the cause of the conflict. Of course, there are other causes there as well. But we're living in a very, very complex time. Now, if you look at the global warming issue, the greenhouse gas emission issue, it's not the developing world that's causing this problem. They're still burning stuff that's very dirty. One of the biggest health problems in countries like India is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. You may not have even heard of it. It's because people, you get it in heavy smokers, it's because people are living in houses where they're burning things for cooking, like camel dung and cow dung, and they're getting all this crap coming up their nose. That's one of the effects of having remote power stations. We've taken all that and we've put it out in the countryside, so we don't do that anymore. We don't burn all this stuff in our house. We don't breathe it all the time, and our lungs are much cleaner as a result. And, of course, many fewer of us are smoking. And though if you go to the developing countries, the increase in cigarette smoking is enormous. I've just been in the Philippines. The principal physician group that I met were pulmonologists, and they're all dealing with the consequences of smoking and a disaster it continues to be. Now, how does the developing world play into climate change? Well, in several ways. Firstly, it's clearance of forests because they need more agricultural land. So we're constantly, with increasing numbers, we're degrading good agricultural land and good productive land. They're doing it there. We're doing it here. We're about to expand Melbourne again. I'm sure we'll put it on good agricultural land. It's not an unlimited resource. Then you're getting the effect of desertification because as you clear tropical rainforests, a lot of the soil quality is not very good, in fact. And it leaches out very, very quickly. So as they clear tropical rainforests, firstly, we remove a lot of those big sinks that take up the CO2. These are our principal CO2 sinks, apart from the ocean, which is the biggest of all. And we lose that. So John Howard was quite right in saying one of the things we must do is actually put money out there to pay people to keep those tropical rainforests. And I think we're going to have to do that. I think we can't expect them not to have some growth in their economy, some resources, and we're going to have to help them pay to keep those resources for us, because these are global resources. They're not local resources. They're for everybody. Then the next thing, of course, is saltation of soil and all the rest of it. When it comes to the greenhouse gas emission problem itself, as globalisation has increased prosperity for many people, it's probably dragged down prosperity a little in countries like the United States, but it's certainly increased prosperity in China and India and all the rest of it. That means that people in China and India now want to drive cars. They are buying cars. We're getting emissions from that. They're living to a higher standard of living. You go into China, you'll see air conditioners everywhere. One of the good things you also see is a lot of solar collectors. They've gone into that in a fairly substantial way. But that is a big dynamic, and you know, of course, anyone who's been in China, Asia recently, knows about the enormous cloud of pollution that hangs over the place. Actually, it diminishes a bit of the global warming effect because it blocks it, but at the same time, it has other deleterious consequences on things like monsoon rains and so forth because the particle size is too small to get rain in the normal patterns. So it's a very, very complex set of issues with this. So we can't say you can't do that, but the mathematics become impossible. We've seen what's been happening with petrol prices. Now, petrol prices have been going up, they'll do this. But there is no way that they cannot keep going up. It's just numbers. It's just mathematical certainty. It's supply. Even as we turn to other sorts of supply, like shale, say, in northern Canada or whatever, we're still going to have the same sort of problem, that the demand is going to increase enormously as countries like China and so forth come forward. So we have to find some better solution there. And it's not just the problem will not go away. We all know about the increasing CO2 levels. I look at the journals on this. There's Science and Nature are the two big science journals that publish a lot of sort of general stuff. They're sort of the newspapers for scientists where you read about the stuff that's not in your field and you get good summaries and things they could then use in views. If you actually try and read the papers, like most scientific papers, so the language is often so arcane and peculiar that it's like, oh God, what's the most painful experience you can think of? Well, I won't tell you what my most painful experience is because you might enjoy it, but yeah, it's not fun. But you, for instance, we're worried a lot about the loss of corals. We're worried about coral bleaching with warming of the ocean. But one of the, it's now, as the science goes on, and it goes on all the time, we're finding that actually some of the corals are benefiting from the increased CO2. They're actually taking up, making more calcium and calcifying more. So there we have a benefit. You're all aware, I think, that the Arctic is melting much, much more quickly than anyone thought it would. It was thought initially it would be gone by 2050, now in summer. Now maybe it's 2030 it'll be gone in summer. But on the other hand, the recent data suggests that Greenland may not be melting quite as quickly as we thought. It was thought that that the melting would create greater slippage and the ice would be slipping into the water much more. And that, the data is showing that's not happening to the extent. So maybe Greenland is actually going a lot slower than we thought. The Antarctic, very hard to know. Antarctic is much colder than the Arctic. We were expecting increased snow accumulation. That may sound paradoxical, but as the water evaporates more in the tropics and goes down over the Antarctic, then you get more snow precipitation. That's what the climatologist was predicting. But then on the other hand, we're not seeing so much of that. We're also seeing a bit more melting of some of the ice sheets. So a lot of uncertainty here. Of course, the whole global warming thing, as many have said, both for and against, is based on various mathematical models. The models have various outcomes depending on the parameters you put into them. You put in the best data you've got, but the way you weight those models, of course, will give you a different sets of outcomes. The more measurements we get, the more data we get, the more certain we become of various types of trends. And that process will continue as this whole evaluation continues. So what does this all say for Australia? Well, I'd like to suggest to you that we have some enormous opportunities in Australia in these difficult times, because it is a difficult time. I think the meteorologists have been telling us we're not going to get the same sort of rainfall in southern Australia that we're used to, and that's certainly been happening. We had hoped that we were getting an El Niño effect and we were going to get a lot more rain. Well, it hasn't really happened. And, of course, Perth is building its second desalination plant. Adelaide is building a desalination plant. Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane's talking about it. So we know there are changes in realities. But if you think about it, there are also opportunities there for us. One of the great opportunities we have, I think, is we've got an enormous country with only 21 million people. Now, most of that is desert, and you might think of it as useless. But you could actually cover a hell of a lot of it with solar collectors or solar furnaces or wind turbines or anything you want. And if it's not down towards Warrnambool or in East Gippsland or something, I mean, if it's around the Great Australian Bight, who's going to give a damn, quite frankly? So you could generate a lot of power. Of course, the power is rather remote. We've got the geothermal possibility of getting power in that way. If our water has to come from desalination, well, what the hell does it matter where we are on the coastline? As long as we're on a coastline, we don't have to be in Melbourne. I'm not sure. I really wonder whether the right thing is to expand big cities like Melbourne, or we should be doing more to develop regional centres like, say, Warrnambool, Portland, those towns, which do have, in many cases, better rainfall. There's a lot of opportunity there, but I think it requires a lot of innovative thinking. It requires a lot more research. Now, with due respect, Australian industry, partly for cultural reasons, partly for regulatory reasons, partly because of the way it's owned, even the big industry has not really been stepping up to the plate much in research and development. There's less. It's been happening internationally. As companies have accumulated together in the drug industry, they've been doing less research and development and relying more on buying IP in from outside. And I think if you look at the mining industry here, you find for the size of it, there's not a massive amount. I was in Korea recently. I was in a city called Pohang. Has anyone been to Pohang? Yeah, you know about it. Pohang is the home of Post-Tech University. You heard of Post-Tech? Post-Tech is Korea. They like to think of it as Korea's Caltech. Caltech doesn't necessarily like to think of itself as America's Post-Tech, but they like to think of themselves as Caltech. So what's Caltech? It's a university that has about 1,000 undergraduates and about 2,500 postgraduates. They have about the same ratio. And Post-Tech was started by the POSCO Steel Company. It said, they were saying, we don't have enough trained engineers, we don't have enough trained scientists, we are going to start our own university. So they did. Can you imagine BHP starting a university? Yeah, well, I heard one of the guys from there talk. He seemed to be very impressed with the fact they were doing research on putting video cameras on trucks. So post-sec university has now largely been taken over by the state. It has exactly that mandate. As I understand it, the kids are not charged to go there. They go, they're trained, and of course they're available for Korean industry. As you fly into Pohang, you look down and you see enormous piles of Australian coal and Australian iron ore. Okay, that makes it even sadder, doesn't it, really? I mean, you know, here we are shipping off coal and iron ore. Why can't we have steel plants here? If we've got all this potential for energy, why does it have to be done there? Is it cheaper to ship ore, or is it cheaper to ship steel? If we have geothermal energy, for instance, or we have enormous solar resources, can't we use some of that to change the face of our industry? So I think we have a lot of possibilities. But we haven't always been that great at seizing them. We didn't invent drip irrigation. We didn't invent capillary irrigation. The Israelis did in a very harsh environment. I think we should look at what we are, look at what we have, look at the best we can do. And I think also we have to change the model of saying, you know, business does this, government does that. Things are only going to happen if we do what the Asian countries do, like Taiwan and Singapore and Korea, and that is if government, industry, academia, whatever, works together, and the financial institutions. We have to work together to pull this country forward. I think we've actually got a government who's interested in thinking along those lines. Kim Carr, I've met with a couple of times, and I'm very impressed with him. I think he's a very good minister. And, of course, it's time for change, and we do have some resources. So I think we could look forward to an exciting future. But like everything else, we have to seize the day. Thank you.